So I thought, since I'm going to be teaching about God's timing, it would be kind of embarrassing if I ran late. So to help me stay on time here, we'll bring that out there. I think I can flip it over once and I'll be good. But I wanted to wear a clock around my neck, but I thought, you know, channeling Flava Flav was probably not the right vibe for this crowd, so. All righty. Well, this is my family here, wife Sarah. We have three boys, Zach, Nate, and Jacob, who's actually, he's hidden away over there. He's 6 weeks now, but a little bit more about how God's perfect timing played its role in our family next week. But anyway, just wanted to introduce us first, and a little bit more about our family and timing. You know, one way in which timing is a source of tension in our family is punctuality. I tend to want to be a little bit more on time, and Sarah seems to maybe underestimate the amount of time it takes to prepare to leave the house. So from very early on in our marriage, when I discovered this, I came up with what I call Sarah time. So if we need to be somewhere at 6:30, and it's going to take half an hour to get there, I might say, okay, we need to leave at 5:30 or 5:45, and when we inevitably leave at 6, we're actually likely to get there on time. So, anybody else do that a little bit? Okay, see a few hands. Well, and that dynamic also applies to Sunday mornings, not this morning, actually, surprisingly, but, you know, where we're rushing out of the house and trying to get all five of us ready. But one thing you'll notice if you get to know me, I like to make little references to songs, a little phrase here, or you know, certain circumstances might conjure up a song title or lyric. So if you could put a soundtrack to our Sunday morning preparations, here's 10 songs that might be part of that soundtrack. Get Ready by The Temptations. I Will Wait by Mumford & Sons. Come As You Are by Nirvana. Right Here Waiting by Richard Marx. Patience by Guns N' Roses. Waiting for a Girl Like You by Foreigner. That classic from My Fair Lady, Get Me to the Church on Time. Sitting, Waiting, Wishing by Jack Johnson. Come, Now Is the Time to Worship. And for those Texans in the room, by Brad Paisley, Waiting on a Woman. So, does anybody here actually like waiting? I see no hands. Okay, that's not surprising. If there was a hand, I might ask them to leave or actually come up and teach, because I don't think, I certainly don't like to wait. And it's actually part of our human nature, I think, to hate waiting. People even, as we saw, write songs about it. So, you know, whether it's standing in the line at Starbucks, sitting in the drive-thru at Chick-fil-A, snaking through the TSA security line at the airport, stuck in traffic on the Beltway or any of the area's roads, for that matter, on hold with customer service, we just don't like waiting, and we spend much of our lives doing it. In fact, I saw one stat, the average person spends 5 years waiting. That's pretty depressing, but... you know, but in all those circumstances I just mentioned, that's, you know, the waiting is really just an inconvenience, it's an annoyance, we'd rather be doing other things. But in a more serious vein, many of us here in this room are waiting for God to deliver us from something. It may be an unfulfilling career, a financial struggle, an illness, emotional pain, interpersonal conflict, infertility, or even an addiction. And if you aren't waiting for God right now, you probably have been waiting on Him at some point in your life, and in all likelihood, you will find yourself in a season of waiting at some point in the future. So my hope for this two-part series is to help us trust God during times of waiting. And as I said, as human beings, our nature is to be impatient. We want the answers now. We want our desires fulfilled now. But you know, and oftentimes the answer from God is, not now. And so naturally we hate waiting even more when we're in the midst of unpleasant, difficult circumstances. But the good news, which we'll explore today, is that God's timing is perfect. And we're going to see how that's evident in the life of Christ, particularly focusing on the last week of His life. And then next week, we'll talk a little bit more about how God's perfect timing gives us confidence to trust him during these periods of waiting, even when the circumstances are difficult. All right, so first, a little bit of overview, just very quickly, different perspectives on time between us and God. So we exist on a timeline. There's our past behind us, and we're there at the present, but we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or 5 or 10 years from now. There's any number of possible futures. That's because we lack the vision of what will happen in the future. God, however, sits outside of that timeline. He sees time all at once, the past, the present, and the future. And so that uncertain future for us, he knows exactly what will happen and when it will happen. And so that actually is one thing we can take confidence as we face uncertainty in the future. For God, there is no uncertainty. He's omniscient, and he's all-powerful, and so he knows what's going to happen. Ecclesiastes also talks a little bit about God's timing. Ecclesiastes 3:1 says there's an appointed time for everything. There's a time for every event under heaven. Speaking of songs, the birds put that to music many years ago. And then in verse 11 there, he has made everything appropriate in its time. And so we'll see how this is manifest in the life of Christ, a specific timing for specific events. The biblical narrative can be viewed as a series of events perfectly designed in time by God to preserve his people, the Israelites, so that he could bring about his plan of salvation at precisely the right time. And we see this in dozens of places throughout the Old Testament, whether it's Joseph, you know, being delivered and put in a position of power and influence in Egypt, whether it's God using Moses to deliver the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt and into the Promised Land. But another famous story you may be familiar with is that of Esther, who God allowed to become in a position of influence in the court of the king of Persia, Xerxes, again, to save her people, the Israelites, when an evil high official, Haman, sought to destroy them. And so in Esther 4:13 and 14, Mordecai, her uncle, says to some messengers to tell Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you will have not attained royalty for such a time as this." I think Esther is just a beautiful story of how God perfectly orchestrated events, again, at just the right moment to have Esther in position to intercede with Xerxes and thwart Haman's plan and save the Jews, the Israelites. And this idea of God's timing for his plan of salvation is also, Paul writes about this in Galatians 4, "When the fullness of time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, so that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons." And somebody much smarter than I put it this way, John MacArthur, "In God's timetable, when the exact religious, cultural, and political conditions demanded by his perfect plan were in place, Jesus came into the world." And so, not only his birth, but as we'll see, all of the individual events throughout his ministry and even the last week and hours of his life were perfectly timed to achieve God's plan of salvation. And so we're going to look at that here momentarily. But before we do that, a little bit of a language exploration here in the Greek. So the word time shows up in a number of different ways in the Greek New Testament. The first, probably the most familiar to most of us, is chronos. This is kind of measurable physical time. You know, you see this word in words like chronology, chronometer. At the Olympics, chronos was very much at the forefront of everyone's minds, you know, measuring time, beating the clock, racing one another. But time also shows up in the New Testament in a couple of abstract ways. The first is the word hora, which is translated as hour or time or moment. It can mean a specific, you know, like 60-minute period, but it's also used more abstractly as just a particular moment or time. And then another word is kairos, which sometimes gets translated as the proper time, due time, the appointed time or season. And so as we look through the Jesus's life here, we'll see these two words, hora and kairos, showing up in various places to represent the sort of appointed time or due time or hour at which he is his crucifixion is appointed. And actually, I've highlighted in the passages here, I think yellow for hora, blue for kairos, just so you can kind of see when those words are used. Grab some water here. All right. Okay, so as we look at the precise timing of Christ's sacrifice, the first scenario or situation we'll look at is the Feast of Tabernacles. This is recorded in John chapter 7 and 8. At the time, Jesus was walking in Galilee, and John 7, 1 says he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Despite this, his brothers urged him to go to Jerusalem to attend this Feast of Tabernacles, also known as Sukkot, and make himself publicly known to the Jews there. But in John 7, verse 6, Jesus tells them, "My time is not yet here." And again, this time is the word kairos. As John MacArthur writes, "It was not in God's perfect timing for Jesus to go to the feast." This sentence reveals Jesus' complete dependence on and commitment to the Father's sovereign timetable for his life. And that's a theme we're going to see as we go through all of these examples. And so Jesus continues and tells his brothers, "Go to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to the feast because my time has not yet fully come." And so he waits, so they go ahead. As it turns out, Jesus does actually go up to the feast, although he does so initially in secret. That is, until he basically reveals himself and starts teaching to the people there, kind of blows his cover, so to speak. When he does that, then people start asking, they recognize him, they say, "Is this not the man whom they are seeking to kill? Look, he is speaking publicly, and they are saying nothing to him." And the "they" here being Jesus' enemies. And this is the first indication we get where we see God is restraining Jesus' enemies. It says they are saying nothing to him. It's as if he is sort of binding them with ropes to prevent them from seizing Jesus or taking him at this time. And in verse 30, we see this exactly. "So they were seeking to seize him, and no man laid his hand on him because his hour had not yet come." And knowing that his enemies were restrained, Jesus had the confidence to be able to teach and come out very controversially with a number of statements. For example, in verse John 8:19, he says, "If you knew me, you would know my Father also," which the high priests and the teachers in the Jewish church recognized as or viewed as blasphemy, essentially equating himself with God. But again, the very next verse, John 8:20, says no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. A little bit later, he says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am." Again, another just really explosive statement. He says, "I am." That's the Old Testament way that God refers to himself, the "I am." And so he is saying, "I am God." And at this point, you know, they're probably tearing their robes and just like, "We need to get this guy." But they don't, because God's constrained them and it's not the right hour. And in fact, John 8:59 says, "Therefore they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple." So, very much a very easy opportunity for his enemies to seize him and drag him away or just kill him on the spot, but it wasn't the right time. And it wasn't God's plan, so it didn't happen. Another example is, moving a little bit forward, this would be basically the week leading up to the crucifixion. Jesus on Palm Sunday, what we recognize as Palm Sunday, has this triumphal entry into Jerusalem, where he was there to celebrate the Passover. At that time, some Greeks asked Jesus' disciples if they could see him. His response was, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And then a little bit later, he says, "Now my soul has become troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I came to this hour." And so here we see within Jesus his own perfect understanding of God's salvation plan and the timing thereof, as well as the suffering that he was going to face and be required to endure. Even now, he's already, the human part of Christ is already starting to say things like, should I ask Father to save me from this hour? And we'll see this again in a little bit later. But he knows that, no, I can't do that because my purpose is to fulfill this plan of salvation. And as Jesus and his disciples are preparing to celebrate the Passover, which we know is the Last Supper, he tells his disciples, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is near. I am to keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" He then prepares to wash his disciples' feet before dinner and says in John 13:1, "Now before the feast of the Passover," this is actually John commenting, "Now before the feast of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he would depart out of this world to the Father." Again, so there at the as he's preparing to celebrate the Passover with his disciples, he knows that hour is approaching. Go ahead and turn this over. And then let's see here. After the Last Supper, Jesus has a very long intercessory prayer. He prays for himself, for his disciples, for the world. And at one point he says, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you." So here we see throughout these verses, earlier on we saw, "My time has not yet come. The hour has not yet come." It becomes, "The hour is coming." And now he says, "The hour has come." So we're right on the cusp of the fulfillment of this, centuries-long plan that is perfectly timed. And after the supper, he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane to continue praying. He goes off by himself. He asks Peter, James, and John to keep watch. Of course, they fall asleep, not once, but three times. It says, "He began to pray that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by." So once again, Jesus' humanity kind of comes to the surface here, where he's asking God the Father, "Hey, I know what horrible suffering I'm about to endure, and not just that, I know you're going to turn your back on me entirely. I'd rather not endure that if possible. So what do you think? Let me spare me from that?" But again, he knows that's not what is God's plan. In Mark 14:36, he says, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." So then he returns from praying, again, finds his disciples asleep for the third time, and then tells them, "Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners." I mean, Jesus now, instead of having, dwelling in the humanity, he has this omniscience of being deity at this time, and he knows what's about to happen, which is he's about to be delivered into the hands of his enemies. And then after Judas betrays Jesus, Jesus addressed the chief priests and officers of the temples and says, "While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours." So again, Jesus is referring to those previous times where they had the chance to seize him or kill him and saying, "Look, your hands were God tied your hands back then." But then he's acknowledging, "You know what? Those constraints, those restraints are off. So I'm yours to do with as you see fit." And obviously what that leads to is his crucifixion. In Romans 5:6, Paul writes, For while we were still helpless, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. I mean, even the very second of his death, when his body expired its last breath and his heart stopped beating on the cross, that was perfectly timed by God to work that plan of salvation. Not a lot of application in this particular lesson, but my goal was to kind of show that arc of how timing, the perfect timing developed over the last week of Christ's life up to his crucifixion. And what we'll do when we get into next week is we will, hopefully this will give us a better understanding of and comfort in God's perfect timing, so that as we look into how we can respond to periods of waiting in difficult circumstances, we can start with that foundation of confidence in God's perfect timing.